There were two other things she said on the way back, one with her mouth and one with her eyes. The one she said out loud was that she'd been thinking of packing her things and running away. That seemed at least like a way out. But running won't solve your problems if you've been hurt bad enough. Wherever you run, you take your head and your heart with you, after all. And the thing I saw in her eyes was that the thought of suicide had done more than just cross her mind. I'd think of that, of seeing the thought of suicide in my daughter's eyes, and then I'd see Joe's face even clearer with that eye inside me. I'd see how he must have looked, pestering her and pestering her, trying to get a hand up under her skirt until she wore nothing but jeans in self-defense, not getting what he wanted, or not all of what he wanted, because of simple luck, her good and his bad, and not for any lack of trying. I thought about what might have happened if Joe Jr. hadn't cut his playing with Willie Bramhall short a few times and come home early, or if I hadn't finally opened my eyes enough to get a really good look at her. Most of all, I thought about how he'd driven her. He'd done it the way a bad-hearted man with a quirt or a greenwood stick might drive a horse, and never stop once, not for love and not for pity, until that animal lay dead at his feet. And him probably standing above it with a stick in his hand, wondering why in hell that happened. This was where wanting to touch his forehead, wanting to see if it felt as smooth as it looked, had gotten me. This was where it all come out. My eyes were all the way open, and I saw I was living with a loveless, pitiless man who believed anything he could reach with his arm and grasp with his hand was his to take, even his own daughter. I'd gotten just about that far in my thinking when the thought of killing him crossed my mind for the first time. That wasn't when I made up my mind to do it. Gory, no. But I'd be a liar if I said the thought was only a daydream. It was a lot more than that. Selina must have seen some of that in my eyes, because she laid her hand on my arm and says, "Is there going to be trouble, Mommy? Please say there isn't. He'll know I told, and he'll be mad." I wanted to soothe her heart by telling her what she wanted to hear, but I couldn't. There was going to be trouble. Just how much and how bad would probably be up to Joe. He'd backed down that night I hit him with the creamer, but that didn't mean he would again. "I don't know what's going to happen," I said, "but I'll tell you two things, Selina. None of this is your fault, and his days of pawing and pestering you are over. Do you understand?" Her eyes filled up with tears again, and one of them spilled over and rolled down her cheek. "I just don't want there to be trouble," she said. She stopped a minute, her mouth working, and then she busts out, "Oh, I hate this! Why did you ever hit him? Why did he ever have to start up with me? Why couldn't things stay like they were?" I took her hand. "Things never do, honey. Sometimes they go wrong and then they have to be fixed. You know that, don't you?" She nodded her head. I saw pain in her face, but no doubt. "Yes," she said, "I guess I do." We were coming into the dock then, and there was no more time for talk. I was just as glad. I didn't want her looking at me with those tearful eyes of hers, wanting what I guess every kid wants, for everything to be made right but with no pain and nobody hurt. Wanting me to make promises I couldn't make because they were promises I didn't know if I could keep. I wasn't sure that inside eye would let me keep them. We got off the ferry without another word passing between us, and that was just as fine as paint with me. That evening, after Joe got home from the Carstairs place where he was building a back porch, I sent all three kids down to the market. I saw Selina casting little glances back at me all the way down the drive, and her face was just as pale as a glass of milk. Every time she turned her head, Andy, I saw that double-damned hatchet in her eyes. But I saw something else in them, too, and I believe that other thing was relief. "At least things are going to quit just going around and around like they have been," she must have been thinking. Scared as she was, I think part of her must have been thinking that. Joe was sitting by the stove reading the American like he done every night. I stood by the wood box, looking at him, and that eye inside seemed to open wider than ever. Look at him, I thought, sitting there like the grand high poobah of Upper Buck Crack. Sitting there like he didn't have to put on his pants one leg at a time like the rest of us. Sitting there as if putting his hands all over his only daughter was the most natural thing in all the world, and any man could sleep easy after doing it. I tried to think of how we'd gotten from the junior-senior prom at the Samoset Inn to where we were right now. Him sitting by the stove and reading the paper in his old patched blue jeans and dirty thermal undershirt, and me standing by the wood box with murder in my heart. And I couldn't do it. It was like being in a magic forest where you look back over your shoulder and see the path has disappeared behind you. Meantime, that inside eye saw more and more. It saw the crisscross scars on his ear from when I hit him with the creamer. It saw the squiggly little veins in his nose. It saw the way his lower lip pushed out so he almost always looked like he was having a fit of the sulks. It saw the dandruff in his eyebrows, and the way he'd pull at the hairs growing out of his nose, or give his pants a good tug at the crotch every now and then. All the things that I saw were bad, and it come to me that marrying him had been a lot more than the biggest mistake of my life. It was the only mistake that really mattered, because it wasn't just me that would end up paying for it. It was Selena he was occupied with then, but there were two boys coming along right behind her, and if he wouldn't stop at trying to rape their big sister, what might he do to them? I turned my head, and that eye inside saw the hatchet, laying on the shelf over the wood box just the same as always. I reached out for it and closed my fingers around the handle, thinking, I ain't gonna put it in your hand this time, Joe. Your head, maybe, but not your hand. Then I thought of Selena turning back to look at me as the three of them walked down the driveway, and I decided that whatever happened, the goddamn hatchet wasn't going to be any part of it. I bent down and took a chunk of rock maple out of the wood box instead. Hatchet or stove length, it almost didn't matter. Joe's life come within a whisker of ending right then and there. The longer I looked at him sitting in his dirty shirt, tugging at the hairs sticking out of his nose and reading the funny pages, the more I thought of what he'd been up to with Selena. The more I thought about that, the madder I got. The madder I got, the closer I came to just walking over there and breaking his skull open with that stick of wood. I could even see the place I'd hit the first lick. His hair had started to get real thin, especially in back, and the light from the lamp beside his chair made a kind of gleam there. You could see the freckles on the skin between the few strands of hair that was left. Right there, I thought. That very place. The blood'll jump up and spatter all over the lampshade, but I don't care. It's an ugly old thing anyway. The more I thought about it, the more I wanted to see the blood flying up onto the shade like I knew it would. And then I thought about how drops would fly onto the light bulb, too, and make a little sizzling sound. I thought about those things, and the more I thought, the more my fingers bore down on that chunk of stove wood, getting their best grip. It was crazy. Oh, yes. But I couldn't seem to turn away from him. And I knew that inside eye would go on looking at him even if I did. I told myself to think about how Selena would look at me if I did it. How her eyes would say that my temper was every bit as bad as Joe had said it was, and all her worst fears had come true. But that didn't work either. As much as I loved her, and as much as I wanted her good regard, it didn't. That eye was too strong for love. Not even wondering what would happen to the three of them if he was dead and I was in South Windham for killing him would make that inside eye close up. It stayed wide open, and it kept seeing more and more ugly things in Joe's face. The way he scraped white flakes of skin up from his cheeks when he shaved. A blob of mustard from his dinner drying on his chin. His big old horsey dentures, which he got from mail order and didn't fit him right. And every time I saw something else with that eye, my grip on that stove length would tighten down a little more. At the last minute, I thought of something else. If you do this right here and right now, you won't be doing it for Selena, I thought. You wouldn't be doing it for the boys, either. You'd be doing it because all that grabbing was going on under your very nose for 3 months or more, and you was too dumb to notice. If you're going to kill him and go to prison and only see your kids on Saturday afternoons, you better understand why you're doing it. Not because he was at Selena, but because he fooled you. That finally put a damper on me. The inside eye didn't close, but it dimmed down and lost a little of its power. I tried to open my hand and let that chunk of rock maple fall, but I'd been squeezing it too tight and couldn't seem to let it go. I had to reach over with my other hand and pry the first two fingers off before it dropped back into the wood box, and the other three fingers stayed curled like they were still holding on. I had to flex my hand 3 or 4 times before it started to feel normal again. After it did, I walked over to Joe and tapped him on the shoulder. "I want to talk to you," I says. "So talk," he says from behind the paper. "I ain't stopping you." "I want you looking at me when I do," I says. "Put that rag down." He dropped the paper into his lap and looked at me. "Ain't you got the busiest mouth on you these days," he says. "I'll take care of my mouth," I says. "You just want to take care of your hands. If you don't, they're going to get you in more trouble than you could handle in a year of Sundays." His brows went up, and he asked me what that was supposed to mean. "It means I want you to leave Selena alone," I says. He looked like I'd hoik my knee right up into his family jewels. That was the best of a sorry business, Andy. The look on Joe's face when he found out he was found out. His skin went pale, and his mouth dropped open, and his whole body kind of jerked in that shitty old rocker of his, the way a person's body will jerk sometimes when they are just falling off to sleep and have a bad thought on the way down. He tried to pass it off by acting like he'd had a muscle twinge in his back, but he didn't fool either one of us. He actually looked a little ashamed of himself, too, but that didn't win him any favor with me. Even a stupid hound dog has sense enough to look ashamed if you catch it stealing eggs out of a hen house. "I don't know what you're talking about," he says. "Then how come you look like the devil just reached into your pants and squeezed your balls?" I asked him. The thunder started to come onto his brow then. "If that damn Joe Jr.'s been telling lies about me," he begun. "Joe Jr. ain't been saying yes, no, I, nor maybe about you," I says. "And you can just drop the act, Joe. Selena told me. She told me everything. How she tried to be nice to you after the night I hit you with the cream pitcher, how you repaid her, and what you said would happen if she ever told." "She's a little liar," he says, throwing his paper on the floor like that proved it. "A little liar and a goddamn tease. I'm going to get my belt, and when she shows her face again, if she ever dares to show it around here again..." He started to get up. I took one hand and shoved him back down again. It's awful easy shoving a person who's trying to get out of a rocking chair. It surprised me a little how easy it was. Of course, I'd almost bashed his head in with a stove length not 3 minutes before, and that might have had something to do with it. His eyes went down to narrow little slits, and he said I'd better not fool with him. "You've done it before," he says, "but that don't mean you can bell the cat every time you want to." I'd been thinking that very thing myself, and not so long before, but that wasn't hardly the time to tell him so. "You can save your big talk for your friends," I says instead. "What you want to do right now isn't talk, but listen. And hear what I say, because I mean every word. If you ever fool with Selena again, I'll see you in state prison for molesting a child or statutory rape Whichever charge will keep you in cold storage the longest. That flummoxed him. His mouth fell open again, and he just sat there for a minute, staring up at me. "You'd never," he begun, and then stopped, because he seen that I would. So he went into a pet, with his lower lip pooching out farther than ever. "You take her part, don't you?" he says. "You never even asked for my side of it, Dolores." "Do you have one?" I asked him back. "When a 40-year-old man asks his 14-year-old daughter to take off her underpants so he can see how much hair she has growing on her pussy, can you say that man has a side?" "She'll be 15 next month," he says. As if that somehow changed everything. He was a piece of work, all right. "Do you hear yourself?" I asked him. "Do you hear what's running out of your own mouth?" He stared at me a little longer, then bent over and picked his newspaper up off the floor. "Leave me alone, Dolores," he says in his best, sulky, poor old me voice. "I want to finish this article." I felt like tearing the damn paper out of his hands and throwing it in his face. But there would have been a blood-flowing tussle for sure if I had, and I didn't want the kids, especially not little Pete, coming in on something like that. So I just reached out and pulled down the top of it, gentle, with my thumb. "First, you're going to promise me you'll leave Selena alone," I said, "so we can put this shit-miserable business behind us. You promise me you ain't going to touch her that way ever again in your life." "Dolores, you ain't," he starts. "Promise, Joe, or I'll make your life hell." "You think that scares me?" he shouts. "You've made my life hell for the last 15 years, you bitch. Your ugly face can't hold a candle to your ugly disposition. If you don't like the way I am, blame yourself." "You don't know what hell is," I said. "But if you don't promise to leave her alone, I'll see you find out." "All right," he yells. "All right, I promise. There, done. Are you satisfied?" "Yes," I says, although I wasn't. He wasn't ever going to be able to satisfy me again. It wouldn't have mattered if he'd worked the miracle of the loaves and fishes. I meant to get the kids out of that house or see him dead before the turn of the year. Which way it went didn't make much difference to me, but I didn't want him to know something was coming his way until it was too late for him to do anything about it. "Good," he says. "Then we're all done and buttoned up, ain't we, Dolores?" But he was looking at me with a funny little gleam in his eyes that I didn't much like. "You think you're pretty smart, don't you?" "I dunno," I says. "I used to think I had a fair amount of intelligence, but look who I ended up keeping house with." "Oh, come on," he says, still looking at me in that funny half-wise way. "You think you're such hot shit, you probably look over your shoulder to make sure your ass ain't smoking before you wipe yourself. But you don't know everything." "What do you mean by that?" "You figure it out," he says, and shakes his paper out like some rich guy who wants to make sure the stock market didn't use him too bad that day. "It shouldn't be no trouble for a smarty pants like you." I didn't like it, but I let it go. Partly it was because I didn't want to spend any more time knocking a stick against a hornet's nest than I had to. But that wasn't all of it. I did think I was smart, smarter than him anyway. And that was the rest of it. I figured if he tried to get his own back on me, I'd see what he was up to about 5 minutes after he got started. It was pride, in other words, pride pure and simple. And the idea that he'd already got started never crossed my mind. When the kids came back from the store, I sent the boys into the house and walked around to the back with Selena. There's a big tangle of blackberry bushes there, mostly bare by that time of the year. A little breeze had come up, and it made them rattle. It was a lonesome sound, a little creepy, too. There's a big white stone sticking out of the ground there, and we sat down on it. A half moon had risen over East Head, and when she took my hands, her fingers were just as cold as that half moon looked. "I don't dare go in, Mommy," she said, and her voice was trembling. "I'll go to Tanya's, all right? Please say I can. You don't have to be afraid of a thing, sweetheart, I says. It's all taken care of. I don't believe you, she whispered, although her face said she wanted to. Her face said she wanted to believe it more than anything. It's true, I said. He's promised to leave you alone. He doesn't always keep his promises, but he'll keep this one, now that he knows I'm watching, and he can't count on you to keep quiet. Also, he's scared to death.
Scared to death? Why?
Because I told him I'd see him in Shawshank if he got up to any more nasty business with you. She gasped, and her hands bore down on mine again.
Marnie, you didn't.
Yes, I did, and I meant it, I says. Best for you to know that, Selina. But I wouldn't worry too much. Joe probably won't come within 10 feet of you for the next 4 years, and by then you'll be in college. If there's one thing on this round world he respects, it's his own hide. She let go of my hands, slow but sure. I saw the hope coming into her face, and something else as well. It was like her youth was coming back to her. And it wasn't until then, sitting in the moonlight by the blackberry patch with her, that I realized how old she'd come to look that fall.
He won't strap me or anything? She asked.
No, I says, it's done. Then she believed it all and put her head down on my shoulder and started to cry. Those were tears of relief, pure and simple. That she should have to cry that way made me hate Joe even more. I think that for the next few nights there was a girl in my house sleeping better than she had for 3 months or more. But I laid awake. I'd listen to Joe snoring beside me and look at him with that inside eye and feel like turning over and biting his goddamn throat out. But I wasn't crazy anymore, like I'd been when I almost poleaxed him with that stick of stove wood. Thinking of the kids and what would happen to 'em if I was taken up for murder, hadn't had any power over that inside eye then. But later on, after I'd told Selina she was safe and had a chance to cool off a little myself, it did. Still, I knew that what Selina most likely wanted, for things to go on like what her dad had been up to, had never happened. Couldn't be. Even if he kept his promise and never touched her again, that couldn't be. And in spite of what I'd told Selina, I wasn't completely sure he'd keep his promise. Sooner or later, men like Joe usually persuade themselves that they can get away with it next time. That if they're only a little more careful, they can have whatever they like. Lying there in the dark and calm again at last, the answer seemed simple enough. I had to take the kids and move to the mainland, and I had to do it soon. I was calm enough right then, but I knew I wasn't going to stay that way. That inside eye wouldn't let me. The next time I got hot, it would see even better, and Joe would look even uglier, and there might not be any thought on earth that could keep me from doing it. It was a new way of being mad, at least for me, and I was just wise enough to see the damage it could do if I let it. I had to get us away from Little Tall before that madness could break all the way out. And when I made my first move in that direction, I found out what that funny, half-wise look in his eyes meant. Did I ever? I waited a while for things to settle. Then I took the 11 o'clock ferry across to the mainland one Friday morning. The kids were in school, and Joe was out on the bounding main with Alan Stargill and his brother Gordon, playing with the lobster pots. He wouldn't be back till almost sundown. I had the kids' savings account passbooks with me. We'd been putting money away for their college ever since they were born. I had, anyway. Joe didn't give a squitter if they went to college or not. Whenever the subject came up, and it was always me who brought it up, of course, he'd most likely be sitting there in his shitty rocker with his face hid behind the Ellsworth American, and he'd poke it out just long enough to say, "Why in Christ's name are you so set on sending those kids to college, Dolores? I never went, and I did all right." Well, there's some things you just can't argue with, ain't there? If Joe thought that reading the paper, mining for boogers, and wiping them on the runners of his rocking chair was doing all right, there wasn't no room at all for discussion. It was hopeless from the word go. That was all right, though. As long as I could keep making him kick in his fair share if he happened to fall into something good, like when he got on the county road crew. I didn't give a shit if he thought every college in the country was run by the commies. The winter he worked on the road crew on the mainland, I got him to put $500 in their bank accounts. And he whined like a pup. Said I was taking all his dividend. I knew better, though, Andy. If that son of a whore didn't make $2,000, maybe $2,500 that winter, I'll smile and kiss a pig. "Why do you always want to nag me so, Dolores?" he'd ask. "If you were man enough to do what's right for your kids in the first place, I wouldn't have to," I'd tell him. And around it'd go, blah, blah, blah-de-blah. I got pretty sick of it from time to time, Andy. But I almost always got out of him what I thought the kids had coming. I couldn't get too sick of it to do that, because they didn't have nobody else to make sure their future'd still be there for them when they got to it. There wasn't a lot in those three accounts by today's standards. $2,000 or so in Selena's, about $800 in Joe Jr.'s, $400 or $500 in Little Pete's. But this is 1962 I'm talking about, and in those days it was a fairish chunk of change. More than enough to get away on, that was for sure. I figured to draw Little Pete's in cash and take cashier's checks for the other two. I'd decided to make a clean break and move us all the way down to Portland. Find a place to live and a decent job. We wasn't none of us used to city living. But people can get used to damn near anything if they have to. Besides, Portland wasn't really much more than a big town back then. Not like it is now. Once I got settled, I could start putting back the money I'd had to take, and I thought I could do it. Even if I couldn't, they was bright kids, and I knew there were such things as scholarships. If they missed out on those, I decided I wasn't too proud to fill out a few loan applications. The major thing was to get them away. Right then, doing that seemed a lot more important than college. First things first, as the bumper sticker on Joe's old formal tractor used to say. I've run my gums for pretty near 3/4 of an hour about Selena, but it wasn't only her who'd suffered from him. She got the worst of it, but there was plenty of black weather left over for Joe Jr. He was 12 in 1962, a prime age for a boy, but you wouldn't know it looking at him. He hardly ever smiled or laughed any more. And it really wasn't any wonder. He'd no more than come into the room and his dad'd be on him like a weasel on a chicken, telling him to tuck in his shirt, to comb his hair, to quit slouching, to grow up, stop acting like a goddamn sissy with his nose always stuck in a book, to be a man. When Joe Jr. didn't make the Little League All-Star team the summer before I found out what was wrong with Selena, you would have thought, listening to his father, that he'd been kicked off the Olympic track team for taking pep pills. Add to that whatever he'd seen his father getting up to with his big sister, and you got a real mess on your hands, Sonny Jim. I'd sometimes look at Joe Jr. looking at his father and see real hate in that boy's face. Hate, pure and simple. And during the week or two before I went across to the mainland with those passbooks in my pocket, I realized that when it came to his father, Joe Jr. had his own inside eye. Then there was little Pete, the apple of his dad's eye. By the time he was 4, he'd go swaggering around right behind Joe with the waist of his pants pulled up like Joe wore his, and he'd pull at the end of his nose and his ears just like Joe did. Little Pete didn't have any hairs there to pull, of course, so he'd just pretend. On his first day at first grade, he came home sniveling, with dirt on the seat of his pants and a scratch on his cheek. I sat down beside him on the porch step, put my arm around his shoulders, and asked him what happened. He said that goddamn little sheeny Dickie O'Hara pushed him down. I told him goddamn was swearing and he shouldn't say it, then asked him if he knew what a sheeny was. I was pretty curious to hear what might pop out of his mouth, to tell you the truth. "Sure I do," he says. "A sheeny's a stupid jerk like Dickie O'Hara." I told him no, he was wrong. And he asked me what it did mean then. I told him to never mind. It wasn't a nice word, and I didn't want him saying it any more. He just sat there glaring at me with his lip pooched out. He looked just like his old man. Selena was scared of her father. Joe Jr. hated him. But in some ways, it was Little Pete who scared me the most, because Little Pete wanted to grow up to be just like him. So I got their passbooks from the bottom drawer of my little jewelry box. I kept them there because it was the only thing I had in those days with a lock on it. I wore the key around my neck on a chain, and walked into the Coastal Northern Bank in Jonesport at about 12:30. When I got to the front of the line, I pushed the passbooks across to the teller, said I meant to close all three accounts out, and explained how I wanted the money. "That'll be just a moment, Mrs. St. George," she says, and goes to the back of the teller's area to pull the accounts. This was long before computers, of course, and they had to do a lot more fiddling and diddling. She got 'em. I saw her pull all three, and then she opened 'em up and looked at 'em. A little line showed up down the middle of her brow, and she said something to one of the other women. Then they both looked for a while, with me standing out there on the other side of the counter, watching 'em and telling myself there wasn't a reason in the world to feel nervous, and feeling pretty goddamn nervous just the same. Then, instead of coming back to me, the teller went into one of those jumped-up little cubbyholes they called offices. It had glass sides, and I could see her talking to a little bald man in a gray suit and a black tie. When she came back to the counter, she didn't have the account files anymore. She'd left them on the bald fella's desk. "I think you'd better discuss your children's savings account with Mr. Pease, Mrs. St. George," she says, and pushes the passbooks back to me. She did it with the side of her hand, like they were germy and she might get infected if she touched them too much or too long. "Why?" I asked. "What's wrong with them?" By then I'd given up the notion that I didn't have anything to feel nervous about. My heart was rapping away double time in my chest and my mouth had gone all dry. "Really, I couldn't say. But I'm sure that if there's a misunderstanding, Mr. Pease will straighten it right out," she says. But she wouldn't look me in the eye, and I could tell she didn't think any such thing. I walked to that office like I had a 20-pound cake of cement on each foot. I already had a pretty good idea of what must have happened, but I didn't see how in the world it could have happened. Gory, I had the passbooks, didn't I? Joe hadn't got 'em out of my jewelry box and then put 'em back, either, because the lock would have been busted, and it wasn't. Even if he'd picked it somehow, which is a laugh, that man couldn't get a forkful of peas from his plate to his mouth without dropping half of 'em in his lap. The passbooks would either show the withdrawals or be stamped account closed in the red ink the bank uses, and they didn't show neither one. Just the same, I knew that Mr. Pease was going to tell me my husband had been up to fuckery, and once I got into his office, that was just what he did tell me. He said that Joe Jr.'s and Little Pete's accounts had been closed out 2 months ago, and Selena's less than 2 weeks ago. Joe had done it when he did because he knew I never put money in their accounts after Labor Day until I thought I had enough squirreled away in the big soup kettle on the top kitchen shelf to take care of the Christmas bills. Pease showed me those green sheets of ruled paper accountants use, and I saw Joe had scooped out the last big chunk, $500 from Selena's account. The day after, I told him I knew what he'd been up to with her, and he sat there in his rocker and told me I didn't know everything. He sure was right about that. I went over the figures 6 times, and when I looked up, Mr. Pease was sitting across from me, rubbing his hands together and looking worried. I could see little drops of sweat on his bald head. He knew what had happened as well as I did. "As you can see, Mrs. St. George, those accounts have been closed out by your husband, and..." "How can that be?" I asks him. I threw the three passbooks down on his desk. They made a whacking noise, and he kind of blinked his eyes and jerked back. "How can that be, when I got the Christie savings account books right here?" "Well," he says, licking his lips and blinking like a lizard sunning itself on a hot rock, "you see, Mrs. St. George, those were what we call custodial savings accounts. That means the child in whose name the account is held could draw from it with either you or your husband to countersign. It also means that either of you can, as parents, draw from any of these three accounts when and as you like, as you would have done today if the money had still, been in the accounts. But these don't show any goddamn withdrawals, I says. And I must have been shouting because people in the bank were looking around at us. I could see them through the glass walls. Not that I cared. How'd he get the money without the goddamn passbooks? He was rubbing his hands together faster and faster. They made a sandpapery kind of sound. And if he'd had a dry stick between them, I believe he could have set fire to the gum wrappers in his ashtray. Mrs. St. George, if I could ask you to keep your voice down... I'll worry about my voice, I says, louder than ever. You worry about the way this beshitted bank does business, chummy. The way it looks to me, you got a lot to worry about. He took a sheet of paper off his desk and looked at it. According to this, your husband stated the passbooks were lost, he says finally. He asked to be issued new ones. It's a common enough. Common be damned, I yelled. You never called me. No one from the bank called me. Those accounts were held between the two of us. That's how it was explained to me when we opened Selina's and Joe Jr.'s back in 51, and it was still the same when we opened Peter's in 54. You want to tell me the rules have been changed since then? Mrs. St. George, he started, but he might as well have tried whistling through a mouthful of crackers. I meant to have my say. He told you a fairy story, and you believed it. Asked for new passbooks, and you gave them to him. Gory sakes! Who the hell do you think put that money in the bank to begin with? If you think it was Joe St. George, you're a lot dumber than you look. By then, everybody in the bank had quit even pretending to be going about their business. They just stood where they were looking at us. Most of them must have thought it was a pretty good show, too, judging by the expressions on their faces. But I wonder if they would have been quite so entertained if it had been their kids' college money that had just flown away like a big-ass bird. Mr. Pease had gone as red as the side of old Dad's barn. Even his sweaty old bald head had turned bright red. "Please, Mrs. St. George," he says. By then he was looking like he might break down and cry. "I assure you that what we did was not only perfectly legal, but standard bank practice." I lowered my voice then. I could feel all the fight running out of me. Joe had fooled me all right, fooled me good. And this time I didn't have to wait for it to happen twice to say shame on me. "Maybe it's legal and maybe it ain't," I says. "I'd have to haul you into court to find out one way or the other, wouldn't I? And I ain't got either the time or the money to do it. Besides, it ain't the question what's legal or what ain't that's knocked me for a loop here. It's how you never once thought that someone else might be concerned about what happened to that money. Don't standard bank practice ever allow you folks to make a single goddamn phone call? I mean, the number's right there on all those forms, and it ain't changed. Mrs. St. George, I'm very sorry, but if it had been the other way around," I says, "if I'd been the one with a story about how the passbooks was lost and asked for new ones, if I'd been the one who started drawing out what took 11 or 12 years to put in, would you have called Joe? If the money had still been here for me to withdraw today, like I came in meaning to do, wouldn't you have called him the minute I stepped out the door to let him know, just as a courtesy, mind you, what his wife had been up to? Because I'd expected just that, Andy. That was why I'd picked a day when he was out with the Stargills. I'd expected to go back to the island, collect the kids, and be long gone before Joe come up the driveway with a six-pack in one hand and his dinner pail in the other. Pease looked at me and opened his mouth. Then he closed it again and didn't say nothing. He didn't have to. The answer was right there on his face. Of course he, or someone else from the bank, would have called Joe and kept on trying until he finally got him. Why? Because Joe was the man of the house, that's why. And the reason nobody had bothered to tell me was because I was just his wife. What the hell was I supposed to know about money except how to earn some down on my knees, scrubbing floors and baseboards and toilet bowls. If the man of the house decided to draw out all his kids' college money, he must have had a damn good reason. And even if he didn't, it didn't matter, because he was the man of the house and in charge. His wife was just the little woman, and all she was in charge of was baseboards, toilet bowls, and chicken dinners on Sunday afternoons. If there's a problem, Mrs. St. George, Pease was saying, I'm very sorry, but if you say you're sorry one more time, I'll kick your butt up so high you'll look like a hunchback, I says. But there was no real danger of me doing anything to him. Right about then, I didn't feel like I had enough strength to kick a beer can across the road. Just tell me one thing, and I'll get out of your hair. Is the money spent? I would have no way of knowing, he says in this prissy little shocked voice. You'd have thought I'd told him I'd show him mine if he showed me his. This is the bank Joe's done business with his whole life, I says. He could have gone down the road to Machias or Columbia Falls and stuck it in one of those banks, but he didn't. He's too dumb and lazy and set in his ways. No, he's either stuck it in a couple of mason jars and buried it somewhere or put it right back in here. That's what I want to know. If my husband's opened some kind of new account here in the last couple of months. Except it felt more like I had to know, Andy. Finding out how bad he'd fooled me made me feel sick to my stomach, and that was bad. But not knowing if he'd pissed it all away somehow, that was killing me. If he's, well, that's privileged information, he says. And by then you'd have thought I'd told him I'd touch his if he'd touch mine. Yeah, I says, figured it was. I'm asking you to break a rule. I know just looking at you that you're not a man who does that often. I can see it runs against your grain. But that was my kid's money, Mr. Pease, and he lied to get it. You know he did. The proof's right there on your desk blotter. It's a lie that wouldn't have worked if this bank, your bank, had had the common courtesy to make a telephone call. He clears his throat and starts. We are not required. I know you ain't, I says. I wanted to grab him and shake him, but I saw it wouldn't do no good. Not with a man like him. Besides, my mother always said you can catch more flies with honey than you ever can with vinegar, and I found it to be true. I know that, but think of the grief and heartache you'd have saved me with that one call. And if you'd like to make up for some of it, I know you don't have to, but if you'd like to, please tell me if he's opened an account here, or if I've got to start digging holes around my house. Please, I'll never tell. I swear on the name of God I won't. He sat there looking at me, drumming his fingers on those green accountant sheets. His nails were all clean, and it looked like he'd had a professional manicure, although I guess that ain't too likely. It's Jonesport in 1962 we're talking about, after all. I suppose his wife did it. Those nice, neat nails made little muffled thumps on the papers each time they came down, and I thought, he ain't gonna do nothing for me. Not a man like him. What's he care about island folk and their problems? His ass is covered, and that's all he cares about. So when he did speak up, I felt ashamed for what I'd been thinking about men in general and him in particular. I can't check something like that with you sitting right here, Mrs. St. George, he says. Why don't you go down to the Chatty Buoy and order yourself a cruller and a nice hot cup of coffee? You look like you could use something. I'll join you in 15 minutes. No, better make it half an hour. Thank you, I said. Thank you so very much. He sighed and began shuffling the papers back together. I must be losing my mind, he says, then laughed kind of nervous-like. No, I told him, you're helping a woman who don't have nowhere else to turn, that's all. Ladies in distress have always been a weakness of mine, he says. Give me half an hour, maybe even a little longer. But you'll come? Yes, he said, I will. He did, too, but it was closer to 45 minutes than half an hour. And by the time he finally got to the buoy, I'd pretty well made up my mind he was going to leave me in the lurch. Then, when he finally came in, I thought he had bad news. I thought I could read it in his face. He stood in the doorway a few seconds, taking a good look around to make sure there was nobody in the restaurant who might make trouble for him if we was seen together after the row I made in the bank. Then he came over to the booth in the corner where I was sitting, slid in across from me, and said, "It's still in the bank. Most of it, anyway. Just over $3,000. "Thank God," I said. "Well," he says, "that's the good part. The bad part is that the new account is in his name only." "Of course it is," I said. "He sure didn't give me no new passbook account card to sign. That would have tipped me off to his little game, wouldn't it?" "Many women wouldn't know one way or the other," he says. He cleared his throat, gave a yank on his tie, then looked around quick to see who'd come in when the bell over the door jingled. "Many women sign anything their husbands put in front of them." "Well, I ain't many women," I says. "I've noticed," he says back, kind of dry. "Anyway, I've done what you asked, and now I really have to get back to the bank. I wish I had time to drink a coffee with you." "You know," I says, "I kind of doubt that." "Actually, so do I," he says back. But he gave me his hand to shake, just like I was another man, and I took that as a bit of a compliment. I sat where I was until he was gone, and when the girl came back and asked me if I wanted a fresh cup of coffee, I told her no thanks. I had the acid indigestion from the first one. I had acid indigestion all right, but it wasn't the coffee that gave it to me. A person can always find something to be grateful for, no matter how dark things get. And going back on the ferry, I was grateful that at least I hadn't packed nothing. This way I didn't have all that work to undo again. I was glad I hadn't told Selina either. I'd set out to, but in the end I was afraid the secret might be too much for her, and she'd tell one of her friends and word might get back to Joe that way. It had even crossed my mind that she might get stubborn and say she didn't want to go. I didn't think that was likely. Not the way she flinched back from Joe whenever he came close to her. But when it's a teenage girl you're dealing with, anything's possible. Anything at all. So I had a few blessings to count, but no ideas. I couldn't very well take the money out of the joint savings account me and Joe had. There was about $46 in it. And our checking account was an even bigger laugh. If we weren't overdrawn, we were damn close. I wasn't going to just grab the kids up and go off, though. No, sir, and no, ma'am. If I did that, Joe'd spend the money just for spite. I knew that as well as I knew my own name. He'd already managed to get through over $300 of it, according to Mr. Pease. And of the $3,000 left, I'd put at least $2,500 away myself. I earned it, scrubbing floors and washing windows and hanging out that damn bitch Vera Donovan's sheets. 6 pins, not just 4. All summer long. It wasn't as bad then as it turned out to be in the wintertime, but it still wasn't no day in the park, not by a long shot. Me and the kids were still gonna go. My mind was made up on that score. But I was damned if we was gonna go broke. I meant my children to have their money. Going back to the island, standing on the foredeck of the Island Princess with a fresh open-water wind cutting itself in two on my face and blowing my hair back from my temples, I knew I was going to get that money out of him again. The only thing I didn't know was how. Life went on. If you only looked at the top of things, it didn't look like anything had changed. Things never do seem to change much on the island. If you only look at the top of things, that is. But there's lots more to a life than what a body can see on top. And for me, at least, the things underneath seemed completely different that fall. The way I saw things had changed. And I suppose that was the biggest part of it. I'm not just talking about that third eye now. By the time little Pete's paper spooks had been taken down and his little pictures of turkeys and pilgrims had gone up, I was seeing all I needed to with my two good natural eyes. The greedy piggy way Joe'd watch Selina sometimes when she was in her robe, for instance. Or how he'd look at her butt if she bent over to get a dishcloth out from under the sink. The way she'd swing wide of him when he was in his chair and she was crossing the living room to get to her room. How she'd try to make sure her hand never touched his when she passed him a dish at the supper table. It made my heart ache for shame and pity, but it also made me so mad that I went around most days feeling sick to my stomach. He was her father, for Christ's sake. His blood was running in her veins. She had his black Irish hair and double-jointed little fingers. But his eyes'd get all big and round if she was wearing a sleeveless blouse and her bra strap so much as fell down the side of her arm. I seen the way Joe Jr. also swung wide of him and wouldn't answer what Joe asked him if he could get away without doing it, and answered in a mutter when he couldn't. I remember the day Joe Jr. brought me his report on President Roosevelt when he got it back from the teacher. She'd marked it A+, and wrote on the front that it was the only A+ she'd given a history paper in 20 years of teaching, and she thought it might be good enough to get published in a newspaper. I asked Joe Jr. if he'd like to try sending it to the Ellsworth American, or maybe the Bar Harbor Times. I said I'd be glad to pay for the postage. He just shook his head and laughed. It wasn't a laugh I liked much. It was hard and cynical, like his father's. And have him on my back for the next 6 months, he asked. No, thanks. Haven't you ever heard Dad call him Franklin D. Sheenyvelt? I can see him now, Andy, only 12, but already pert near 6 feet tall, standing on the back porch, with his hands stuffed down deep in his pockets, looking at me as I held his report with the A+ on it. I remember the little tiny smile on the corners of his mouth. There was no goodwill in that smile, no good humor, no happiness. It was his father's smile, although I could never have told the boy that. Of all the presidents, Dad hates Roosevelt the most, he told me. That's why I picked him to do my report on. Now give it back, please. I'm going to burn it in the wood stove. No, you ain't, Sonny Jim, I says. And if you want to see what it feels like to be knocked over the porch rail and into the dooryard by your own mom, you just try to get it away from me. He shrugged. He'd done that like Joe, too. But his smile got wide. And it was sweeter than any his father ever wore in his life when it did that. Okay, he said. Just don't let him see it, okay? I said I wouldn't, and he run off to shoot baskets with his friend Marky Giggory. I watched him go, holding his report and thinking about what had just passed between us. Mostly what I thought about was how he'd gotten his teacher's only A+ in 20 years, and how he'd done it by picking the president his father hated the most to make his report on. Then there was little Pete, always swaggering around with his butt switching and his lower lip pooched out, calling people sheenies and being kept after school 3 afternoons out of every 5 for getting in trouble. Once I had to go get him because he'd been fighting and hit some other little boy on the side of the head so hard he made his ear bleed. What his father said about it that night was, I guess he'll know to get out of your way the next time he sees you coming, won't he, Petey? I saw the way the boy's eyes lit up when Joe said that, and I saw how tenderly Joe carried him to bed an hour or so later. That fall it seemed like I could see everything but the one thing I wanted to see most, a way to get clear of him. You know who finally gave me the answer? Vera. That's right. Vera Donovan herself. She was the only one who ever knew what I did, at least up until now. And she was the one who gave me the idea. All through the 50s, the Donovans were the summer people of all summer people. They showed up Memorial Day weekend, never left the island all summer long, and went back to Baltimore on Labor Day weekend. I don't know as you could set your watch by 'em, but I know damn well you could set your calendar by 'em. I'd take a cleaning crew in there the Wednesday after they left and swamp the place out from stem to stern, stripping beds, covering furniture, picking up the kids' toys and stacking the jigsaw puzzles down in the basement. I believe that by 1960, when the mister died, there must have been over 300 of those puzzles down there, stacked up between pieces of cardboard and growing mildew. I could do a complete cleaning like that because I knew that the chances were good no one would step foot into that house again until Memorial Day weekend next year. There were a few exceptions, of course. The year that little Pete was born, they come up and had their Thanksgiving on the island. The place was fully winterized, which we thought was funny. But, of course, summer people mostly are funny. And a year or two later, they come up for Christmas. I remember the Donovan kids took Selina and Joe Jr. sledding with them Christmas afternoon. And how Selina come home from 3 hours on Sunrise Hill with her cheeks as red as apples and her eyes sparkling like diamonds. She couldn't have been no more than 8 or 9 then, but I'm pretty sure she had a crush the size of a pickup truck on Donald Donovan, just the same. So they took Thanksgiving on the island 1 year, and Christmas on it another. But that was all. They were summer people. Or at least 3 out of 4 of them were. Vera was the fourth. She was from away, but in the end she turned out to be as much an island woman as I am, maybe more. In 1961, things started out just as they had all those other years, even though her husband had died in that car crash the year before. She and the kids showed up on Memorial Day, and Vera went to work doing jigsaw puzzles, collecting shells, smoking cigarettes, and having her special Vera Donovan brand of cocktail hour, which started at 5 and finished around 9:30. But it wasn't the same. Even I could see that. And I was only the hired help. The kids were drawn in and quiet, still mourning their dad, I guess. And not long after the 4th of July, the three of them had a real wowser of an argument while they were eating at the harbor side. I remember Jimmy DeWitt, who waited table there back then, saying he thought it had something to do with the car. Whatever it was, the kids left the next day. The hunky took them across to the mainland in the big motorboat they had, and I imagine some other hired hand grabbed onto them there. I ain't seen neither one of them since. Vera stayed. You could see she wasn't happy, but she stayed. That was a bad summer to be around her. She must have fired half a dozen temporary girls before Labor Day finally came. And when I seen the princess leaving the dock with her on it, I thought, I bet we don't see her next summer, or not for as long. She'll mend her fences with her kids. She'll have to. They're all she's got now. And if they're sick of little Tall, she'll bend to them and go somewheres else. After all, it's coming to be their time now, and she'll have to recognize that. Which only shows you how little I knew Vera Donovan back then. As far as that kitty was concerned, she didn't have to recognize jack shit on a hill of beans if she didn't want to. She showed up on the ferry Memorial Day afternoon in 1962 by herself and stayed right through until Labor Day. She came by herself. She hadn't a good word for me or anybody else. She was drinking more than ever and looked like death's grandma most days. But she came, and she stayed, and she did her jigsaw puzzles, and she went down, all by herself now, and collected her shells on the beach, just like she always had. Once she told me that she believed Donald and Helga would be spending August at Pinewood, which is what they always called the house. You probably know that, Andy, but I doubt if Nancy does. But they never showed up. It was during 1962 that she started coming up after Labor Day. She called in mid-October and asked me to open the house, which I did. She stayed 3 days. The hunky come with her and stayed in the apartment over the garage, then left again. Before she did, she called me on the phone and told me to have Dougie Tappet check the furnace and to leave the dust sheets off the furniture. "You'll be seeing a lot more of me now that my husband's affairs are finally settled," she says. "Perhaps more of me than you like, Dolores. And I hope you'll be seeing the children, too." But I heard something in her voice that made me think she knew that part was wishful thinking, even back then. She come up the next time near the end of November, about a week after Thanksgiving, and she called right away, wanting me to vacuum the downstairs and change the bed linen upstairs. The sheets already on the beds were perfectly clean, of course, but clean wasn't enough for Mrs. Vera Kiss My Back Cheeks Donovan. Not nearly enough. She said they smelled musty, and she had no intention of sleeping in musty sheets, or letting her kids sleep in them. They were in boarding school, but she said they might decide at the last minute to spend the weekend with her instead of staying where they were. She probably knew better, but Vera was a Boy Scout at heart, believed in being prepared, she did. I was able to come right away, that being a slack time on the island for folks in my line of work. I trudged up there in a cold rain with my head down and my mind fuming away like it always did in the days after I found out what had happened to the kids' money. My trip to the bank had been almost a whole month before, and it had been eating away at me ever since, the way battery acid will eat a hole in your clothes or your skin if you get some on you. I couldn't eat a decent meal, couldn't sleep more than 3 hours at a stretch before some nightmare woke me up, couldn't hardly remember to change my own underwear. My mind was never far from what Joe'd been up to with Selina, and the money he'd snuck out of the bank, and how was I going to get it back again? I understood I had to stop thinking about those things a while to find an answer. If I could, one might come on its own, but I couldn't seem to do it. Even when my mind did go somewheres else for a little bit, the least little thing would send it tumbling right back down that same old hole. I was stuck in one gear. It was driving me crazy. And I suppose that's the real reason I ended up speaking to Vera about what had happened. I surely didn't mean to speak to her. She'd been as sore-natured as a lioness with a thorn in her paw ever since she showed her face the May after her husband died. And I didn't have no interest in spilling my guts to a woman who acted like the whole world had turned to shit on her. But when I came in that day, her mood had finally changed for the better. She was in the kitchen, pinning an article she'd cut out of the front page of the Boston Globe to the cork bulletin board hung on the wall by the pantry door. She says, "Look at this, Dolores. If we're lucky and the weather cooperates, we're going to see something pretty amazing next summer." I still remember the headline of that article word for word after all these years, because when I read it, it felt like something turned over inside me. "Total eclipse to darken northern New England skies next summer," it said. There was a little map that showed what part of Maine would be in the path of the eclipse, and Vera'd made a little red pen mark along it where Little Tall was. "There won't be another one until late in the next century," she says. "Our grandchildren will see it, Dolores, but we'll be long gone, so we better appreciate this one." "It'll probably rain like a bugger that day," I says back, hardly even thinking about it. And with the dark temper Vera'd been in almost all the time since her husband died, I thought she'd snap at me. Instead, she just laughed and went upstairs, humming. I remember thinking that the weather in her head really had changed. Not only was she humming, she didn't have even a trace of a hangover. About 2 hours later, I was up in her room changing the bed where she'd spend so much time laying helpless in later years. She was sitting in her chair by the window, knitting an Afghan square, and still humming. The furnace was on, but the heat hadn't really took yet. Those big houses take donkeys years to get warm, winterized or not. And she had her pink shawl thrown over her shoulders. The wind had come up strong from the west by then, and the rain hitting the window beside us sounded like handfuls of thrown sand. When I looked out that one, I could see the gleam of light coming from the garage that meant the hunky was up there in his little apartment, snug as a bug in a rug. I was tucking in the corners of the ground sheet. No fitted sheets for Vera Donovan, you can bet your bottom dollar on that. Fitted sheets would have been too easy. Not thinking about Joe or the kids at all for a change. And my lower lip started to tremble. "Quit that," I told myself. "Quit it right now." But that lip wouldn't quit. Then the upper one started to shimmy, too. All at once, my eyes filled up with tears and my legs went weak, and I sat down on the bed and cried. No. No. If I'm going to tell the truth, I might as well go whole hog. The fact is, I didn't just cry. I put my apron up over my face and wailed. I was tired and confused and at the end of my thinking. I hadn't had anything but scratch sleep in weeks and couldn't for the life of me see how I was going to go on. And the thought that kept coming into my head was, guess you were wrong, Dolores. Guess you were thinking about Joe and the kids after all. And of course I was. It had got so I wasn't able to think of nothing else, which was exactly why I was bawling. I don't know how long I cried like that, but I know when it finally stopped, I had snot all over my face and my nose was plugged up and I was so out of breath I felt like I'd run a race. I was afraid to take my apron down, too, because I had an idea that when I did, Vera would say, "That was quite a performance, Dolores. You can pick up your final pay envelope on Friday." Kenapensky, there, that was his name, Andy, I finally thought of it, "will give it to you." That would have been just like her. Except anything was just like her. You couldn't predict Vera even back in those days when she was in her right mind. When I finally took the apron off my face, she was sitting there by the window with her knitting in her lap, looking at me like I was some new and interesting kind of bug. I remember the crawly shadows the rain sliding down the window panes made on her cheeks and forehead. "Dolores," she said, "please tell me you haven't been careless enough to allow that mean-spirited creature you live with to knock you up again." For a second, I didn't have the slightest idea what she was talking about. When she said, "knock you up," my mind flashed to the night Joe had hit me with the stove length and I'd hit him with the creamer. Then it clicked, and I started to giggle. In a few seconds, I was laughing every bit as hard as I'd cried before, and not able to help that any more than I'd been able to help the other. I knew it was mostly horror. The idea of being pregnant again by Joe was about the worst thing I could think of, and the fact that we weren't doing the thing that makes babies anymore didn't change it. But knowing what was making me laugh didn't do a thing about stopping it. Vera looked at me a second or two longer, then picked her knitting up out of her lap and went back to it as calm as you please. She even started to hum again. It was like having the housekeeper sitting on her unmade bed, bellowing like a calf in the moonlight, was the most natural thing in the world to her. If so, the Donovans must have had some peculiar house help down there in Baltimore. After a while, the laughing went back to crying again, the way rain sometimes turns to snow for a little while during winter squalls if the wind shifts the right way. Then it finally wound down to nothing, and I just sat there on her bed, feeling tired and ashamed of myself, but cleaned out somehow, too. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Donovan," I says, "I truly am." "Vera," she says. "I beg pardon?" I asked her. "Vera," she repeated. "I insist that all women who have hysterics on my bed call me by my Christian name thenceforward." "I don't know what came over me," I said. "Oh," she says right back, "I imagine you do. Clean yourself up, Dolores. You look like you dunked your face in a bowl of pureed spinach. You can use my bathroom." I went in to wash my face, and I stayed in there a long time. The truth was, I was a little afraid to come out. I'd quit thinking she was going to fire me when she told me to call her Vera instead of Mrs. Donovan. That ain't the way you behave to someone you mean to let go in 5 minutes. But I didn't know what she was going to do. She could be cruel. If you haven't got at least that much out of what I've been telling you, I've been wasting my time. She could poke you pretty much when and where she liked, and when she did it, she usually did it hard. "Did you drown in there, Dolores?" she calls in, and I knew I couldn't delay any longer. I turned off the water, dried my face, and went back into her bedroom. I started to apologize again right away, but she waved that off. She was still looking at me like I was the kind of bug she'd never seen before. "You know you startled the shit out of me, woman," she says. "All these years I wasn't sure you could cry. I thought maybe you were made of stone." I muttered something about how I hadn't been getting my rest lately. "I can see you haven't," she says. "You've got a matching set of Louis Vuitton under your eyes, and your hands have picked up a piquant little quiver." "I got what under my eyes?" I asked. "Never mind," she says. "Tell me what's wrong." A bun in the oven was the only cause of such an unexpected outburst I could think of. And I must confess, it's still the only thing I can think of, so enlighten me, Dolores. "I can't," I says. And I'll be goddamned if my lower lip didn't start to tremble again. I could feel the whole thing getting ready to kick back on me again, like the crank of my dad's old Model A Ford used to do when you didn't grab it right. If I didn't watch out, pretty soon I was going to be sitting there on her bed again with my apron over my face. "You can and you will," Vera said. "You can't spend the day howling your head off. It'll give me a headache, and I'll have to take an aspirin. I hate taking aspirin. It irritates the lining of the stomach." I sat down on the edge of the bed and looked at her. I opened my mouth without the slightest idea of what was going to come out. What did was this. "My husband is trying to screw his own daughter. And when I went to get their college money out of the bank so I could take her and the boys away, I found he'd scooped up the whole kit and caboodle. No, I ain't made out of stone. I ain't made out of stone at all." I started to cry again, and I cried for quite a while, but not so hard as before, and without feeling the need to hide my face behind my apron. When I was down to Sniffles, she said to tell her the whole story right from the beginning and without leaving a single thing out. And I did. I wouldn't have believed I could have told anyone that story, least of all Vera Donovan, with her money and her house in Baltimore and her pet hunky, who she didn't keep around just to polish her goddamn Lincoln. But I did tell her, and I could feel the weight on my heart getting lighter with every word. I spilled all of it, just like she told me to do. "So I'm stuck," I finished. "I just can't figure out what to do about this son of a bitch. I suppose I could catch on someplace if I just packed the kids up and took them to the mainland. I ain't never been afraid of hard work, but that ain't the point." "What is the point, then?" she asked me. The Afghan square she was working on was almost done. Her fingers were about the quickest I've ever seen. "He's done everything but rape his own daughter," I says. "He scared her so bad, she may never get all the way over it. And he's paid himself a reward of over $3,000 for his own bad behavior. I ain't gonna let him get away with it. That's the friggin' point." "Is it?" she says, in that mild voice of hers. And her needles went click, click, click. And the rain went rolling down the window panes. And the shadows wiggled and squiggled on her cheek and forehead like black veins. Looking at her that way made me think of a story my grandmother used to tell about the three sisters in the stars who knit our lives, one to spin and one to hold and one to cut off each thread whenever the fancy takes her. I think that last one's name was Atropos. Even if it's not, that name has always given me the shivers. "Yes," I says to her, "but I'll be goddamned if I see a way to do him the way he deserves to be done." Click, click, click. There was a cup of tea beside her, and she paused long enough to have a sip. There'd come a time when she'd like as not try to drink her tea through her right ear and give herself a Tetley shampoo, but on that fall day in 1962, she was still as sharp as my father's cutthroat razor. When she looked at me, her eyes seemed to bore a hole right through me to the other side. "What's the worst of it, Dolores?" she says finally, putting her cup down and picking up her knitting again. "What would you say is the worst? Not for Selina or the boys, but for you." I didn't even have to stop and think about it. "That son of a whore's laughing at me," I says. "That's the worst of it for me. I see it in his face sometimes. I never told him so, but he knows I checked at the bank. He knows damn well, and he knows what I found out." That could be just your imagination, she says. I don't give a frig if it is, I shot right back. It's how I feel. Yes, she says, it's how you feel that's important. I agree. Go on, Dolores. What do you mean, go on? I was going to say, that's all there is. But I guess it wasn't, because something else popped out, just like Jack out of his box. He wouldn't be laughing at me, I says, if he knew how close I've come to stopping his clock for good a couple of times. She just sat there looking at me, those dark, thin shadows chasing each other down her face and getting in her eyes so I couldn't read 'em. And I thought of the ladies who spin in the stars again, especially the one who holds the shears. I'm scared, I says, not of him, of myself. If I don't get the kids away from him soon, something bad is going to happen. I know it is. There's a thing inside me, and it's getting worse. Is it an eye? She asked calmly. And such a chill swept over me then. It was like she'd found a window in my skull and used it to peek right into my thoughts. Something like an eye? How'd you know that? I whispered. And as I sat there, my arms broke out in goosebumps, and I started to shiver. I know, she says, and starts knitting a fresh row. I know all about it, Dolores. Well, I'm going to do him in if I don't watch out. That's what I'm afraid of. Then I can forget all about that money. I can forget all about everything. Nonsense, she says. And the needles went click, click, click in her lap. Husbands die every day, Dolores. Why, one is probably dying right now while we're sitting here talking. They die and leave their wives their money. She finished her row and looked up at me, but I still couldn't see what was in her eyes because of the shadows the rain made. They went creeping and crawling all across her face like snakes. I should know, shouldn't I? She says. After all, look what happened to mine. I couldn't say nothing. My tongue was stuck to the roof of my mouth like an inch bug to flypaper. An accident, she says, in a clear voice almost like a school teacher's, is sometimes an unhappy woman's best friend. What do you mean? I asked. It was only a whisper. But I was a little surprised to find I could even get that out. Why, whatever you think, she says. Then she grinned. Not a smile, but a grin. To tell you the truth, Andy, that grin chilled my blood. You just want to remember that what's yours is his and what's his is yours. If he had an accident, for instance, the money he's holding in his bank accounts would become yours. It's the law in this great country of ours. Her eyes fastened on mine, and for just a second, there, the shadows were gone, and I could see clear into them. What I saw made me look away fast. On the outside, Vera was just as cool as a baby sitting on a block of ice. But inside, the temperature looked to be quite a bit hotter. About as hot as it gets in the middle of a forest fire, I'd say at a guess. Too hot for the likes of me to look at for long, that's for sure. The law is a great thing, Dolores, she says. And when a bad man has a bad accident, that can sometimes be a great thing, too. Are you saying? I begun. I was able to get a little above a whisper by then, but not much. I'm not saying anything, she says. Back in those days when Vera decided she was done with a subject, she slammed it closed like a book. She stuck her knitting back in her basket and got up. I'll tell you this, though. That bed's never going to get made with you sitting on it. I'm going down and put on the tea kettle. Maybe when you get done here, you'd like to come down and try a slice of the apple pie I brought over from the mainland. If you're lucky, I might even add a scoop of vanilla ice cream. All right, I says. My mind was in a whirl, and the only thing I was completely sure of was that a piece of pie from the Jonesport bakery sounded like just the thing. I was really hungry for the first time in over 4 weeks. Getting the business off my chest, done that much anyway. Vera got as far as the door and turned back to look at me. "I feel no pity for you, Dolores," she said. "You didn't tell me you were pregnant when you married him, and you didn't have to. Even a mathematical dunderhead like me can count back 9 months on the calendar and draw the right conclusions. What were you, 3 months gone?"
"Two," I said. My voice had sunk back to a whisper. "Selina come a little early."
She nodded. "And what does a conventional little island girl do when she finds the loaf's been leavened? The obvious, of course. But those who marry in haste often repent in leisure, as you seem to have discovered. Too bad your sainted mother didn't teach you that one, along with there's a heartbeat in every potato and use your head to save your feet. But I'll tell you one thing, Dolores. Bawling your eyes out with your apron over your head won't save your daughter's maidenhead if that smelly old goat really means to take it. Or your children's money if he really means to spend it. But sometimes men, especially drinking men, do have accidents. They fall down stairs, they slip in bathtubs, and sometimes their brakes fail and they run their BMWs into oak trees when they're hurrying home from their mistress's apartments in Arlington Heights. She went out then, closing the door behind her. I made up the bed, and while I did it, I thought about what she'd said. About how when a bad man has a bad accident, sometimes that can be a great thing, too. I began to see what had been right in front of me all along, what I would have seen sooner if my mind hadn't been flying around in a blind panic like a sparrow trapped in an attic room. By the time we'd had our pie and I'd seen her upstairs for her afternoon nap, the could-do part of it was clear in my mind. I wanted to be shut of Joe. I wanted the kid's money back, and most of all, I wanted to make him pay for all he'd put us through, especially for all he'd put Selina through. If the son of a bitch had an accident, the right kind of accident, all those things would happen. The money I couldn't get at while he was alive would come to me when he died. He might have snuck off to get the money in the first place, but he hadn't ever snuck off to make a will cutting me out. It wasn't a question of brains. The way he got the money showed me he was quite a bit slyer than I'd given him credit for, but just the way his mind worked. I'm pretty sure that down deep, Joe St. George didn't think he was ever going to die. And as his wife, everything would come right back to me. By the time I left Pinewood that afternoon, the rain had stopped, and I walked home real slow. I wasn't even halfway there before I'd started to think of the old well behind the woodshed. I had the house to myself when I got back. The boys were off playing, and Selina had left a note saying she'd gone over to Mrs. Devereaux's to help her do a laundry. She did all the sheets from the Harborside Hotel in those days, you know. I didn't have any idea where Joe was, and didn't care. The important thing was that his truck was gone, and with the muffler hanging by a thread the way it was, I'd have plenty of warning if he came back. I stood there a minute, looking at Selina's note. It's funny, the little things that finally push a person into making up her mind, sending her from could-do to might-do to will-do, so to speak. Even now, I'm not sure if I really meant to kill Joe when I came home from Vera Donovan's that day. I meant to check on the well, yes, but that could have been no more than a game, the way kids play let's pretend. If Selina hadn't left that note, I might never have done it. And no matter what else comes of this, Andy, Selina must never know that. The note went something like this. "Mom, I have gone over to Mrs. Devereaux's with Cindy Babcock to help do the hotel wash. They had lots more people over the holiday weekend than they expected, and you know how bad Mrs. D's arthritis has gotten. The poor dear sounded at her wit's end when she called. I will be back to help with supper. Love and kisses, Sel. I knew Selina'd come back with no more'n $5 or $7, but happy as a lark to have it. She'd be happy to go back if Mrs. Devereaux or Cindy called her again, too. And if she got offered a job as a part-time chambermaid at the hotel next summer, she'd probably try to talk me into letting her take it, because money is money. And on the island in those days, trading back and forth was still the most common way of life, and cash a hard commodity to come by. Mrs. Devereaux would call again, too, and be delighted to write a hotel reference for Selina if Selina asked her to, because Selina was a good little worker, not afraid to bend her back or get her hands dirty. She was just like me when I was her age, in other words, and look how I turned out. Just another cleaning witch with a permanent stoop in her walk and a bottle of pain pills in the medicine cabinet for my back. Selina didn't see nothing wrong with that, but she'd just turned 15. And at 15, a girl don't know what the hell she's seeing, even when she's looking spang at it. I read that note over and over, and I thought, frig it. She ain't gonna end up like me, old and damn near used up at 35. She ain't gonna do that even if I have to die to keep her from it. But you know something, Andy? I didn't think things would have to go that far. I thought maybe Joe was gonna do all the dying that needed to be done around our place. I put her note back on the table, did up the snaps on my slicker again, and pulled on my gum rubber boots. Then I walked around back and stood by the big white stone where mean Selina sat the night I told her she didn't have to be afraid of Joe anymore, that he'd promised to let her alone. The rain had stopped, but I could still hear the water dripping deep in the blackberry tangle behind the house and see drops of water hanging off the bare branches. They looked like Vera Donovan's diamond drop earrings, only not so big. That patch covered better'n half an acre. And by the time I'd pushed my way in, I was damn glad I had on my slicker and tall boots. The wet was the least of it. Those thorns were murder. In the late 40s, that patch had been flowers and field grass, with the wellhead sitting on the shed side of it. But about 6 years after me and Joe were married and moved onto the place, which his Uncle Freddy left him when he died, the well went dry. Joe got Peter Doyon to come over and douse us a new one on the west side of the house. We've never had a spot of water trouble since. Once we stopped using the old well, the half-acre behind the shed grew up in those chest-high snarls of scrub blackberry, and the thorns tore and pulled at my slicker as I walked back and forth looking for the board cap on the old well. After my hands got cut in 3 or 4 places, I pulled the sleeves down over 'em. In the end, I almost found the damn thing by falling into it. I took a step onto something that was both loose and kind of spongy. There was a crackling noise under my foot, and I drew back just before the board I'd stepped on gave way. If I'd been unlucky, I'd have fallen forward, and the whole cap would most likely have collapsed. Ding-dong bell, pussies in the well. I got down on my knees, keeping one hand up in front of my face so the blackberry thorns wouldn't scratch my cheeks or maybe put out one of my eyes, and took a good close look. The cap was about 4 feet wide and 5 feet long. The boards were all white and warped and rotted. I pushed on one of them with my hand, and it was like pushing down on a licorice stick. The board I'd put my foot on was all bowed down, and I could see fresh splinters sticking up from it. I would have fallen in all right. And in those days, I went about 120. Joe weighed at least 50 pounds more'n that. I had a handkerchief in my pocket. I tied it around the top of a bush on the shed side of the cap so I could find it again in a hurry. Then I went back into the house. That night I slept like a lamb, and I had no bad dreams for the first time since I'd found out from Selina what her Prince Charming of a dad had been up to with her.